with the aim of buying land from Palestinians and, in a broader perspective, for the development of Jewish lands in Palestine. These movies also depicted the Arabs of Palestine in the form of primitive people, serfs, and without any national identity, who were wandering about in the desolate and barren desert. The model of the narrative structure of what later became known as the Israeli cinema is the product of that period. This structure narrated history like this. Jewish immigrants took root in an inhabited and abandoned territory, expanded it, and made it prosperous. Movies that announced the discovery of a lost paradise that had no owners. Hence, moviegoers all around the world watched the story of the Zionists like a big luck for the Palestinians. The migration that brought culture and wealth to the quote-unquote miserable land. On the other side of the world, Jewish capitalists who were fleeing the war and had entered the U.S. a little earlier and founded Hollywood started making films from the very first days that completed the narrative of the Zionist cinema. Legendary Hollywood producers, the Warner Brothers, Samuel Goldwyn, and Louis Mayer presented a fixed and dangerous stereotype of the hated Arabs in their movies. Wild and backward people, who soon became the most infamous characters of Hollywood. With the help of the silver screen, the image of the confrontation between educated Jewish immigrants and primitive Arab inhabitants occupied the historical memory of moviegoers all over the world. In the Middle East, Arabs, like many Eastern societies, got to know cinema from the 1920s. In the 1930s, cinema halls were established in all major cities of Palestine. But the way cinema entered the Palestinian society turned into a big issue. Most of the movies that were shown on the silver screens were Egyptian musical comedies. Superficial melodramas that exposed private romantic relationships to the public for the first time. Religious figures, not only in Palestine, but also in Syria, Egypt, and Jordan, constantly asked the authorities to stop the movies or at least censor them. Despite all of this, the cinema seemed insignificant compared to the great problems that Palestinians were dealing with. 10 years had passed since Palestine was Britain's tutelage. At the turn of the 1930s, an influx of Jewish migrants started from everywhere in the world towards Palestine, and the Arabs were slowly realizing that they were being trapped. It was during that period when Palestinian protests in the cities of Al-Quds and Jaffa turned bloody and the British army suppressed the Arab uprisings. Arab leaders showed up claiming they want to resolve the problem of the Palestinian people, but their presence was so ineffective that it was unclear whether they were going there to protect Al-Quds or to say goodbye to it. 1935, Saudi King Abdulaziz bin Saud went to Al-Quds. The only thing that made this trip different was the presence of a Palestinian with his camera, Ibrahim Hassan Sarhan. Sarhan made a 20-minute movie of the event and started the Palestinian cinema. At that time, Sarhan and a few other passionate filmmakers experienced making movies again, a cinema that has no trace today except for the memories of the people and the notes printed in the newspapers back then. It looked like Palestinian cinema was being shaped, but the storm of events that soon reached Palestine shattered the dreams of the first generation of Palestinian filmmakers. The situation in Palestine worsened with the start of the Second World War. The Zionists were moving Jews from Eastern Europe and America to Palestine in droves. By the end of the war, the Jewish population had increased from 5% at the beginning of the 20th century to 30%. The increase in population coincided with the decline of Britain, which had suffered a huge loss in the heart of the war front. Britain, that once claimed that the sun never sets on the territory of its empire, turned into a toothless lion at the end of the war that was not even capable of protecting its smallest and closest colonies. Now, the maintenance of Palestine required at least 100,000 soldiers.
Part 1A.
The bankrupt and weak British Parliament immediately left the issue of Palestine to the United Nations.
I now declare open the first meeting of the United Nations Palestine Commission.
In 1947, the partition plan of Palestine was approved by the United Nations, and Palestine was divided between the Arabs and the Jews. But it was decided that the Zionists would not have the right to form any government before British forces leave Palestine. It was the golden opportunity the Zionists had been looking for years. From that time on, the Zionist terrorist groups drove the final nail in the coffin of the British Empire with numerous bombings and attacks on British soldiers. May 14th, 1948, the last British ship had not faded away yet when Ben-Gurion announced the existence of Israel in a speech broadcasted by the media.
From the Jewish homeland, Palestine, and the Jewish Brigade.
The skirmish started. Israel occupied Haifa, and pretty soon the cities of Safa and Acre fell. After the bombardment of Jaffa, Sarhan and his friends left all their movies and videos among the blood and fire and ran away. Finally, on May 15, 1948, Israel attacked Al-Quds. On the same day, the Arab armies entered Palestine. Despite the initial victories, the Arabs eventually retreated on all fronts. With the loss of more lands, the number of displaced persons increased by the day. Finally, after a year of conflict, in May of 1949, the Arab countries that rushed to the rescue of the Palestinians surrendered one after the other. The countries inevitably signed the ceasefire agreement. The signing of the agreements paved the way for the acceptance of the usurped government in the United Nations. When the life of the Palestinian community as a political and social entity came to an end, an absolute silence prevailed, a silence of anger and guilty conscience. Life in the coastal cities almost disappeared, and half of the Palestinian citizens became homeless and refugees. About 900,000 displaced people. For years, the refugee ideology dominated the Palestinian culture. Refugees are always pulled here and there, but remain in a temporary state. Memory and nostalgia are a way to understand the history of Palestine, a repressed memory that moves to the subconscious mind like a mental injury and disrupts the sequence of time. The past replaces the present, and the future finds meaning only in the form of a return to the past, a history that endlessly repeats the past that resembles paradise and its collapse. While the Palestinians were shackled with silence, the new storytellers of the Arab world emerged from Egypt. A group known as the Free Officers stage a coup against King Farouk of Egypt. Mohamed Naguib was in the forefront, but everyone knew that the mastermind was none other than Gamal Abdel Nasser, a person who quickly managed to reach the presidency. In a brave move, Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal. The decree had far-reaching and dramatic consequences. Since 1948, Western countries sought to bolster the Israeli regime, and the Suez Canal witnessed the daily traffic of foreign ships and arms. Behind the decree by Nasser, it had many untold stories for the Palestinians. The first dramatic consequence of the brave move happened 3 months later. On October 29th, Israel attacked Egypt and occupied the Sinai Peninsula with the help of French and British forces. The Soviet Union supported Nasser and entered the Egyptian battlefield and stood up against France and England. Finally, Britain and France signed a peace agreement and the Israeli soldiers had to retreat. Thus, Nasser reached the peak of his popularity. He spread his story all over the Arab world. The story of the United Arab Ummah, or nation. For many years, the Arabs had pinned their hopes on Gamal Abdel Nasser, but perhaps most of all, the Palestinian refugees were hopeful about Nasser. the dream of a united Arab nation was meaningless without the freedom of Palestine.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The Limelight.
Britain's jobless crisis is worse than previously thought, as new estimates show more than 400,000 extra people have dropped out of the labour market. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Telegraph has covered the story and tells us more. The National Institute of Economic and Social Research warned businesses have become frustrated with trying to hire British workers and are increasingly looking abroad to fill vacancies. The number of firms registering to become sponsors to hire abroad has doubled in the past 2 years as hundreds of thousands of Britons abandon work. More than 9 million people of working age have dropped out of the jobs market. The economically inactive population has increased by 884,000 since before the pandemic. Wages increase has not persuaded enough of them to take one of the more than 900,000 vacancies on offer. Max Mosley, economist at the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, said, "Instead, employers have been forced to look overseas for the vital staff they need." He added, "International workers are basically propping up the labour market in many ways. It is very challenging for employers, the kind of tools they have at their disposal to raise wages to try to compete, does not work anymore." More than 5 million people are now on out-of-work benefits, up from 3.5 million back in 2015. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, has found 2.8 million people who say they are neither in work nor looking for a job because of long-term sickness. According to the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, claimants are typically spending longer on benefits rather than snapping up the jobs on offer, despite the 6.5% increase in average pay in the year to November. Home Office figures show the number of new work visas offered last year jumped to 169,000, up 50% under pre-COVID levels. The number of businesses registered to sponsor visas has more than doubled since 2021 to 76,310, as bosses struggle to find workers among those already in the United Kingdom. Max Mosley said, "That is why you might see them look towards international workers. Previously, only around 30,000 companies had been registered." Max Mosley said the sudden jump in businesses registering came right at the point in the supply of domestic workers got really tight. So over the pandemic in 2021, reflecting firms potentially becoming frustrated. It comes after David Miles, an executive member of the Office for Budget Responsibility, said the government must not rely on immigration to boost the economy and reduce business debts. He warned that migration is not a solution to the country's long-term financial problems, advising Prime Minister Rishi Sunak that slashing the benefits bill and getting more people into work instead would be unambiguously beneficial for the economy. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, net migration into the United Kingdom hit 672,000 in the 12 months to June of 2023, with the population expected to hit 70 million by the end of 2026. In an effort to reduce the flow of migrants, the British government is raising the salary threshold for skilled workers moving to the United Kingdom. The baseline minimum salary for sponsoring a visa is rising from £26,200 to £38,700 in April, though there are exemptions for health and care workers and teachers. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, is under pressure to cut taxes to make work more attractive. James Reid, Chief Executive of the recruiter Reid Jobs, said the Chancellor should unfreeze income tax thresholds to make work pay and get people back into the labour force. James Reid added, "There are a lot of reasons why someone who wasn't working might think of returning to work at the moment, and making work pay is a really important part of that." The British newspaper The Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Income tax thresholds are normally raised in the United Kingdom in line with inflation, but the bans have been frozen since April of 2022. This was first announced by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer in 2021, and then was extended by Jeremy Hunt until 2028. Soaring pay amid the cost of living crisis means more people are getting pulled into higher tax bans in a stealth tax known as fiscal drag. James Reid, Chief Executive of the recruiter Reid Jobs, said, "We have been through a period of quite severe inflation. The people who are caught in those thresholds now are quite different to what was originally planned." James Reid added, "The more people are working who could be made free of income tax, the better, because it encourages work. That has been going in the opposite direction." According to the Office for Budget Responsibility, by 2029, an extra 4 million people will be paying income tax compared to in 2023. A further 3 million people will have moved into the higher rate tax band. James Reid said Jeremy Hunt's national insurance cut, which kicked in January, has helped to increase people's take-home pay, but the Chancellor should go further and readjust the tax bands to account for inflation. He said, "Anything that can give people some more of their hard-earned cash would be welcomed, and the thresholds are a good place to start." Britain's jobless crisis is worse than previously thought, as new estimates show that more than 400,000 extra people have dropped out of the labour market. According to the Office for National Statistics, there are now 9.25 million people aged between 16 and 64 who are neither in work nor looking for work, meaning they're officially classed as economically inactive. Officials have revised the figures upwards because the adult population is almost 750,000 bigger than previously expected, fueled by greater levels of immigration. The bulk of this 750,000 is made up of people who are not working nor looking for work, as the figure shows that 172,000 are employed, 30,000 are unemployed, and 414,000 are inactive. A Treasury spokesman said, after borrowing £400 billion to protect lives and livelihoods throughout the pandemic and energy shock because of the Russia-Ukraine war, we had to take some difficult decisions to help pay it back. However, with inflation more than halved and because of the progress we have made, we have cut taxes for hard-working people, leaving the average employee £450 a year. And our tax burden remains lower than any major European economy. The Department for Work and Pensions spokesman said, we are clear that migration is not the long-term solution to growing Britain's economy. The spokesman claimed, our welfare reforms are expected to reduce the number of people who would otherwise have been placed on the higher tier of health benefits by 370,000. And our Back to Work plan will help over a million people start and stay in work.
Hidden Files.
Years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible. From misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions, the tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, you know, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare. Not targeting civilian populations and not inflicting collective punishment and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in this show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years. And now, Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people, so-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people. And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists. They're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011, we've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these sanctions are coming home to roost.
And any final comments that you have, Cindy, on this issue?
Many people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so while corporate media is collapsing, we're seeing the rise of alternative media and a rise of truth seekers. So there's still hope. And it's like talking person to person. I'm here in California at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're in Iran 10 and a half hours away from me. And we know, just like exposing the truth from real humans, real workers, real people who are experiencing, you know, the good and the bad, and how we can work together for peace and for economic security and environmental sustainability for the entire world.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy Sheehan, for being with us right here on Hidden Files.
One of the main messages broadcast about people, such as those living in Afghanistan, Venezuela, and Iran, is that they are suffering. We watch corporate media pump out story after story of the suffering of these people living in non-U.S. ally countries and tell how their pain, unlike that of people in Western countries, is the doing of violent criminals ruling their country without popular support. The part the media often entirely skips, however, is the role of the West in causing these issues. A role that can almost be summarized in a single word: sanctions. Sanctions are also known as unilateral coercive economic measures, which means that they are ways for, say, the U.S. to coerce governments of sovereign nations to give in to their demands. The U.S. has the power to do this because the petrodollar system gives the U.S. dollar elevated status as the dominant currency in the global economy. And due to its dominance, it can also punish other governments if they continue to do business with the targets of these coercive measures. In this way, American officials aim to either make the government of the target country obey them, or make its people so desperate that they'll overthrow their government in hopes of improving their situation. And the U.S. has used this form of economic warfare since the 1950s. On a host of different nations, like North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others. Some of the toughest of all sanctions have been imposed on Iran, and politicians like Rudy Giuliani have openly said they are working because they make the people suffer. The biggest victims of this economic terrorism are people with rare diseases who cannot access essential medicines because of these sanctions, and often die as a result.
Well, let me welcome our next guest to Hidden Files.
Alfred Maurice de Zayas. De Zayas is an expert for civil and political rights and has published 9 books on a variety of legal and historical issues. He has been visiting professor of law at numerous universities, including the University of British Columbia in Canada, the Graduate Institute of the University of Geneva, the DePaul University Law School in Chicago, the Human Rights Institute at the Irish National University, Galway, and the University of Trier, Germany. At present, he teaches international law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy.
Oh, welcome to the program, Mr. De Zayas. Let's start off with your perspective on unilateral coercive measures, otherwise known as sanctions.
What must be clear to every listener is that sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions kill just as much as a bullet. Sanctions kill when you siege a town, like the Nazis siege Leningrad. That cost between 700 and 1 million human lives. Now, the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Venezuela are estimated to have cost, in the year 2018 alone, 40,000 deaths. Now, when you add all the deaths attributable to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba, against Nicaragua, against Venezuela, against Syria, against Iran, you're going to go into the hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is not an exaggeration. UNICEF carried out an investigation of sanctions against Iraq back in the 1990s, and the estimate is that 500,000 children died because of the sanctions.
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, you say that sanctions are killing people. Can there be international legal measures taken against these sanctions?
In the light of worldwide deaths, certainly of more than 100,000 human beings directly attributable to United Nations sanctions, this is a matter for Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. This clearly falls under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome, the Statute of the International Criminal Court. That is the article on crimes against humanity. This is what has to be argued in the General Assembly. This is what has to be argued in the Security Council. This is what has to be argued at DESA and all other United Nations agencies. We already have the excellent reports of Alena Dohan. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the adverse impacts of sanctions, not only U.S. sanctions, also sanctions imposed by the United Kingdom and by Canada and by France and Germany, etc., etc. They all kill. And that is so important that the mainstream media pick up on this piece of news. As I say, my American friends know nothing about this. They know nothing about the fact that sanctions kill. They assume that sanctions are there for good reasons to persuade governments to cease violating human rights. So the hypocrisy of it, the, shall we say, the cynicism of it is mind-boggling. But that is the situation we are living in. So my appeal, which I make in my book, Building a Just World Order, is that this issue be before the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, it can also go up to the International Court of Justice. Because the General Assembly, if you get enough votes in the General Assembly, so majority plus one, you can adopt the resolution elevating the question, the legal question of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures under the UN Charter and elevate it to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion.
But what do you think the overall goal is for Washington and its sanctions regime?
Our government, there is what we term the deep state. And the deep state is made up of the military, industrial, digital, financial complex. Essentially, they call the shots. And they're making money. They're making plenty of money with war. They're certainly making a lot of money with the Ukraine war. And they're certainly making a lot of money with the sanctions. So the sanctions is a way, for instance, to prevent countries to do free trade and to buy cheaper where they can in the world. What sanctions have done, and people don't seem to realize it, sanctions have upturned, frustrated, subverted the benefits of globalization. Sanctions have essentially destroyed globalization and the supply chains and everything that goes with it. So that the United States, by weaponizing the dollar, is trying to impose on the rest of the world the U.S. imperial wishes. And as I said, I'm an American citizen, but I think like Noam Chomsky or like Jeffrey Sachs or like Dan Kovalik or Francis Boyle or Stephen Kinzer, who just abhor the weaponization of human rights actually to hurt people. And that exactly is what we're doing, but that with the complicity of the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Fox, and the others.
What can be done to counter these measures?
Until we realize that we are being lied to day in, day out, and that we are in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, we won't be able to make any progress. So what can we do? Certainly give it publicity in the General Assembly, certainly give it publicity in the Security Council, appeal to UNICEF to carry out an investigation of the deaths attributable to sanctions, appeal to the WHO to carry out an investigation of deaths attributable to lack of access to medicine. Similarly, an appeal to the Food and Agriculture Organization, and then elevate the issue to the International Court of Justice. Is this a crime against humanity? Does this amount to a violation of Article 7 of the Statute of Rome? I have no hesitation to say that it does.
Well, do you think that these unilateral sanctions help to create an alliance between those countries which have been sanctioned?
The mindset in Washington is still the mindset of the unipolar world. And the United States just simply is striking right and left and imposing sanctions and intimidating countries and actually engaging in terror against governments, and has an enormous responsibility, both civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, for the consequences of those sanctions. But there again, that is what I say, and what Richard Falk says, and what Jeffrey Sachs says. But that is not what you're going to read in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. And thus far, I don't see the American media changing. I see the American media as the spokes, spokesperson, as the sounding board of the Pentagon and the sounding board of the State Department. So don't expect any level of self-criticism inside the established media. You can read very good analysis in the so-called alternative media.
Are there any final comments you have on this, Mr. DeZayas?
You will see that there's plenty of Americans who think like I do. On the other hand, none of us is in a position of power. None of us is in a position that we can actually influence policy. And we can write our articles and write our analysis and hope that some people who are in a position of power will say, that makes sense. Why not try that? Why not shift? Why not try a different paradigm than the unipolar paradigm that we now have?
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Alfred DeZayas. As many countries continue to be affected by the sanctions regime, there's growing solidarity between many of the targeted countries and increased cooperation between them. These nations have had to be resilient and had to count on their own ingenuity to survive and, for many others, even thrive during these sanctions. And now it appears that the pendulum of global power is swinging, and it is heading towards the east. This should be a very interesting journey, and Hidden Files will keep you informed during this process. Well, it has been a pleasure being with you on this episode of Hidden Files, and hopefully you will join us next week. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
Under an opaque policy condemned as discriminatory and inhumane, the British government has refused dozens of visas for children of migrant single mothers. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. An investigation revealed Britain's Home Office is systematically barring young children from joining their mothers in Britain, despite extensive proof that the women are their primary caregivers. Under an opaque policy condemned as discriminatory and inhumane, the British government has refused dozens of visas for children of migrant single mothers, many of whom came to work in the National Health Service or social care, saying there are no compelling reasons to grant them a visa. The women left their children, some as young as 2 years old, in the temporary care of relatives or friends, while they moved to Britain from countries like Zimbabwe, Zambia, Kenya, South Africa, and India. They say before leaving their country, they had been reassured by their employers that their children would be able to follow them to Britain, in line with current immigration rules, permitting healthcare workers to bring close family members to Britain. But when they applied for their children's visas, their applications were turned down. In refusal letters seen by The Guardian, the Home Office questioned why the children could not stay permanently with their grandparents or other relatives. In other cases, it said there was no reason why they could not go to live with their fathers, even though their mothers had sole custody or their fathers had not seen the children for years. Many of the letters addressed directly to the children conclude, "It was your mother's personal decision to depart for the United Kingdom, and you have not provided sufficient evidence to grant your visa on serious or compelling grounds." The cases have come to light weeks after the government announced a plan to slash immigration by placing restrictions on the dependents of migrants' healthcare workers. Under controversial rules expected to be introduced this spring, care workers coming to the United Kingdom will be barred from bringing their family members to Britain, while other healthcare workers will have to earn £29,000 a year, rising to £38,700 a year in 2025 to be permitted to do so. But scores of applications from such workers are already being quietly refused. The Guardian has examined 10 cases and been alerted to 140 more, where migrant women, all single mothers, have had visas for children denied in the past 18 months. The applications for visas have not been rejected because the Home Office doubts they are genuine or that the women are the children's primary caregivers. Instead, they have been refused under a Home Office rule that a child may only be given a visa if both parents are living in the United Kingdom, unless the parent living in England has sole responsibility. The policy means single parents are required to prove not only that they have sole custody, but that the other parent is not involved in their child's upbringing, something experts say can be hard to do. If the sole responsibility threshold is not met, the Home Office can still grant applications if it believes there are compelling or compassionate grounds for doing so. But as yet, it has declined to do so in the women's cases investigated by The Guardian, which has seen extensive evidence to support the mothers' claims that they are their children's sole caregivers. In many cases, the women gave the Home Office court documents and custody papers proving they were the sole custodian of the child, as well as bank statements, insurance policies, photographs and letters of support from schools, doctors and church leaders. Many also have signed consent letters from their children's fathers, but in some cases this has been used against them. One mother, Getty, had a visa for her 6-year-old daughter denied. The care worker from Zambia says she and the girl's father separated when she was pregnant, and she has always been her sole caregiver. Shortly after she arrived in Britain in March, Getty, 36 years old, submitted an application for a child to join her. She supplied documents including a court order linked to her separation and an affidavit from the girl's father saying it would be in the child's best interest to come to Britain. But the Home Office refused the child a visa, saying the fact that her father had provided a consent letter was proof he was still in her life and could therefore look after her. Getty said the separation had taken a huge toll, adding, "My daughter asks me every day when her papers are going to be ready. I have to be honest with her and tell her I'm still waiting for the papers. She's only used to living with me. It's really, really hard." In another case, a National Health Service nurse who provided the Home Office with a court document proving she had sole custody for her two daughters, aged 4 and 13, was told there were no serious or compelling reasons why the girls needed to join her in Britain. She said, "It's heartbreaking. How can I sleep at night? I am the mother of the children and I have always looked after them."
I'm Fatah Masumi, and this is CIMORG, a special edition dedicated to the 42nd Fajr International Film Festival. A festival that stands out because of the number of animations that were screened.
This year, 4 feature-length animation movies entered the competition. Sheep Hero by Hossein Safarzadegan won the Crystal Seymour, a very recent recognition as the best animation category was officially added to the award list of the Fajr International Film Festival only 6 years ago, in 2019. And that year, in the 37th edition of the festival, the first ever Crystal Seymour was awarded to a feature-length animation movie. The Last Fiction by Ashkan Rahguzar receiving the honor. And this was all thanks to 8 movies that were submitted to the Secretariat of the Festival 4 years earlier, drawing attention to this new form of artistic expression, gaining a foothold in the industry, with the one called The Return by Mohammad Amin Hamedani gaining recognition. All this can be traced back to the first animation that entered the festival, Jamshid and Khurshid by Alireza Yaghmaiyan, an animation movie that made history in 2005 when it appeared on the shortlist of the movies of the festival.
You may be thinking that the Fajr Film Festival is exclusive to filmmakers, critics, and journalists, but no, public screenings are available for ordinary people who line up to watch the movies.
The Fajr International Film Festival is famous for its public screenings, and during the second week of this major cultural event, 56 movie theaters in different provinces across the country also hosted the Fajr Film Festival, with people lining up, and according to schedule, the films of the festival were screened, drawing cinema enthusiasts to the movie theaters for a full week. And that is why the Fajr International Film Festival, Iran's most prestigious cinematic event, is often referred to as a